You're listening to the Holistic Travel Nurse Podcast. Thanks for hanging in and hanging out and getting to know my podcast. I don't put out content on a consistent basis, so if you're looking for someone who puts it out once a week, once a month, or whatever, I haven't been one of those. I have put over 250 episodes out of content that I think is important for people to research and do your own homework. You be the advocate for you, or you be the advocate for your loved one, or you find someone that can be an advocate for you, which is something I like to do as part of my business. I'm looking forward to hearing from you too. So ways you can reach out is an email. It's all in the show notes at holistictravelnurse@gmail.com. I have an Instagram that people reach out to me once in a while about. I'm doing stuff locally, and I'm looking forward to helping my friends locally. And I will be working more on my business plan and what I'll be doing in person for people, and then what I'll be doing like virtually online, what I can do for people. I've had to take a time from putting anything out for a while. Mentally and physically wasn't there, could not do it. And I've had to renew my mind, my body, and going through my own hardships that I'm not ready to talk about on the podcast. But I'm going to share with you, this is going to be like three different things. Dr. Mercola puts out amazing content and interviews, and I just want you to just hear a little this interview. And then I have three things in this, three different people, three different great information, a new vision for your health. This is what it all is about. Understanding and doing the research and getting involved and knowing more about how your body works and how our healthcare system needs some help. That's what this one's about. Our healthcare system needs some help. That's a good one. That's a good way to put this. Here you go.
Has received a lot of publicity in the last few years with COVID for his FLCC, the Frontline COVID Critical Care organization he founded, which has probably the single best protocol for treating COVID and long COVID. And we're going to go into his personal journey and how he was vilified and criticized and discredited. So it's just a magnificent discussion with one of the main pioneers in implementing this type of strategy for COVID.
We had a really successful protocol for treating COVID in the hospital. That's how we really started, you know, the MAF Plus protocol. And so we know it was effective. My results were better than any of my colleagues. But what happened is the hospital decided, you know, to basically outlaw what I was doing. I was the director of the ICU. I had run the ICU for 15 years, and now I was told I can't use safe and effective drugs to treat my patients. Rather, I must use a toxic drug for which the hospital gets an additional bonus. That was a big awakening for me, and it basically speaks to the depth, the breadth of corruption. Basically, you know, the healthcare system is not patient geared or healthcare geared or geared to enlighten patients, improve their health, improve their lifespan, you know, make them happy, improve their general health. The system is designed to make money. Simple as that. Make money for big pharma, make money for the hospitals and the system, and therefore, you know, empower the NIH. So that's a brief overview of this journey that I've traveled. They have persecuted me professionally, personally. Their goal was to take me down and destroy my career. They were somewhat successful in ending my clinical career, but as you know, I'm not going to give up, and I will never give up, because you have to fight for truth and honesty. And I think now I have a much bigger role, because you know, I and you and many of us have revealed the deceit of the system, and we need to empower patients and healthcare providers to do what our Hippocratic duty is to help patients. That's what we're here to do.
Welcome, everyone. Dr. Mercola, helping you take control of your health. And today we are joined by honored guest, Dr. Paul Merrick. I'm sure many of you know who he is, but I will give you a brief summary in case you don't. He is the Merrick of the Merrick Protocol, which he popularized, which is a relatively low dose of intravenous vitamin C. And we'll discuss some of the reasons why it was so low dose, because most clinicians in the field are using much higher doses. But he's a world-class intensive care physician, incredibly well-published, and I think he's the founder of the FLCC, which is the Frontline COVID Critical Care group of physicians who published one of the most rigorous, comprehensive protocols for treating not only COVID, but long COVID. So it's a really great honor and privilege to connect with Dr. Merrick today. This isn't the first time, though, I've tried to connect. I wanted to go into it a little bit, too, because I think it's illustrative of the challenges that we have. And, you know, once you're a physician and you understand the truth, tend to become vilified and discredited. And that is the general perception in the public. And Dr. Merrick went through this in spades. I've certainly been a veteran of this, too. And so much so that the first two times I attempted to interview Dr. Merrick, he refused me. And I suspect it was because of this discrediting. But I'm so delighted and honored now that we can have this dialogue and share it with you, because it's really an important part. And there's a lot of things we're going to talk about today, but I just want to maybe kind of delve into this in a bit. And I'm sure you had your reasons, but my suspicion is, and the conclusion of it, because you're not the only person that, you know, research scientist or, you know, prominent clinician that I've attempted to interview and really dive deep into their work and expose it to the public that has refused to interview with me. And I suspect that the central theme is pretty similar in that they didn't really dive deep into what was going on. So I'm wondering if you could just share your thoughts on this.
Yeah, so I do apologize for refusing to speak with you. It wasn't an intentional personal thing. I think it was at a time that, you know, I was still digesting what was happening, and I was unsure. You know, I didn't realize how important you are in telling the truth and standing up for the truth. And, you know, so I was a little bit protective, but I think we have spoken subsequently. We have subsequently met. And obviously, you know, you're one of my heroes because you stand up for the truth. And obviously, you've known about the dishonesty, the deceit, the deception for much longer than I have. You know, I had swallowed the Kool-Aid. I was a tenured professor of medicine. I was the only one tenured in my department, in fact. And so I believed, you know, the medical literature, I believe the narrative, I believe what I taught. And you can understand how disturbing it is to one's very core when you actually discover that what you've been teaching and what you've been promoting is based on lies, falsehood, and deception. Fortunately, in the ICU, and I think my good friend Pierre would attest to this, most of what we did is based on understanding human physiology. So we were less influenced by the evilness of big pharma, big hospitals, and their collaborators, obviously until COVID came around. You know, prior to COVID has changed the world. And, you know, up until then, we had pretty much therapeutic freedom. You know, patients were critically ill, they were dying, and doctors did what they do. They, at the bedside, they do what they can to save the patient's life. And that was pre-COVID. And then obviously COVID came around and changed that completely. Indeed, as you know, we had a really successful protocol for treating COVID in the hospital. That's how we really started, you know, the Math Plus protocol. And so we know it was effective. My results were better than any of my colleagues. But what happened is the hospital decided, you know, to basically outlaw what I was doing. I was using safe, FDA-approved drugs which have been shown to be effective for COVID. And the hospital I worked at, Centaurus Healthcare System, basically publicly made a statement that the pharmacy would no longer dispense the medications that I had used, which were safe and effective to treat COVID, and that basically all I was left with was remdesivir. And as we know, the use of remdesivir was halted for Ebola just because it was shown to be a toxic drug that killed people. We know that Gilead and the NIH and Fauci cheated they committed scientific fraud in the conduction of the remdesivir study. So it'll be interesting because we're going to talk about the charges against me against scientific fraud. But they committed out-and-out scientific fraud, and we can go into it. And so we know, according to WHO data, this is publicly available data, remdesivir increases the risk of a patient developing renal failure 20-fold, and we know it increases your risk of dying. So you can understand the situation that I was in. I was the director of the ICU. I had run the ICU for 15 years. And now I was told I can't use safe and effective drugs to treat my patients. Rather, I must use a toxic drug for which the hospital gets an additional bonus. And so that was a big awakening for me. And it basically speaks to the depth, the breadth of corruption. And so basically, you know, the healthcare system is not geared. It's not patient geared or healthcare geared or geared to enlighten patients, improve their health, improve their lifespan, you know, make them happy, improve their general health. The system is designed to make money. Simple as that. Make money for big pharma, make money for the hospitals and the system. And therefore, you know, empower the NIH. So that's a brief overview of this journey that I've traveled. And as you say, they have persecuted me professionally, personally. Their goal was to take me down and destroy my career. They were somewhat successful in ending my clinical career. But as you know, I'm not going to give up and I will never give up. Because you have to fight for truth and honesty. And I think now I have a much bigger role because, you know, I and you and many of us have revealed the deceit of the system, and we need to empower patients and healthcare providers to do what our Hippocratic duty is to help patients. That's what we're here to do.
Absolutely. So you mentioned and referenced your math protocol as a combination of drugs, but I would tend to disagree with that because two of those ingredients are actually vitamins. So the math, for those who are on a math plus protocol, for those who aren't familiar with it, is the M is methylprednisolone, the A is ascorbic acid, the T is thiamine or vitamin B1, H is heparin, and the plus are some other drugs that you can elaborate on, but that you revise it and continue to revise it, I'm assuming. So I'm just curious as to, I mean, the fact that you integrated two powerfully important nutrients into the protocol and got amazing results with it. I want you to discuss the results because they were really pretty astounding. You know, a sepsis is a major cause of death in the world. Many people don't appreciate. And the protocol, I believe, was able to knock the death rate down by 80%. So I'm particularly curious as to what contributed to your open mind to integrating these nutrients, and you know, why did you do that? I mean, because you clearly had some commitment to seeking the truth and finding out what really worked, not some drug-driven propaganda.
Yeah, so I'll tell you how it started. So, you know, Math Plus, which was for COVID, was an extension of our HAT protocol for sepsis. And HAT stands for hydrocortisone, ascorbic acid, and thiamine. And so, you know, how did this start? You know, I'm a bedside clinician, and, you know, as Osler said, you learn medicine at the bedside, and the question is why? Because that's where the patient is. The patient's not in a lecture room or in an auditorium or at the end of Zoom. So that's where some of the most important discoveries are made, at the bedside. So what happened was, this goes back to about January 2016. I had a patient who had overwhelming sepsis. I think she was in her 50s. She had biliary sepsis. She arrived in the ICU. She became intubated. She was in renal failure. She was on multiple doses of pressors. And as a doctor, I knew she was going to die. I mean, you just can see it. She was on massive doses of pressors. And you know, when you're at the bedside, you have a duty to the patient. You know, the doctor always thinks, what can I do to help this patient? You know, is there a rabbit that I can pull out of the hat to help her? And it just so happened that I had read some work on vitamin C by Dr. Fowler, you know, in Richmond. And I was really impressed by his work. And I did some reading, and he had done a preliminary study looking at vitamin C in sepsis. And I thought, you know what? Why don't I try it? You know, it's available in the hospital. It's FDA approved. I called my pharmacist. We had vitamin C. I told them what I wanted to do. I explained to the family what we were going to do. And so I decided to use vitamin C. I was unclear about what dose to use. So you talk about the dose, because I never used it before. So I looked at Dr. Fowler's study, and in his paper, he used two different doses, 50 milligrams per kilogram per day and 200. So not knowing any better, I thought, well, I'll go halfway. So we started off on 100 milligrams per kilogram per day, which worked out about 1.5 grams, 6 hourly. And I thought, you know what, vitamin C is anti-inflammatory. I was always very impressed with hydrocortisone for sepsis. And more recently, like a week ago, we now have a paper proving the life-saving benefit of hydrocortisone in pneumonia. So, you know, this wasn't something I'd sucked out of thin air. And then I added thiamine because of its multiple beneficial effects. At first, I thought it may protect against oxalosis with vitamin C, but, you know, that wasn't true. But thiamine actually has important effects in intermediary metabolism, mitochondrial function, energy metabolism. And patients with sepsis are often both vitamin C deficient. In fact, they're all vitamin C deficient, as well as thiamine deficient. So that was the initial rationale for this. And, you know, I thought, well, what do we have to lose? I was convinced the next morning when I came to work, she would not be with us. And I can tell you, I was completely dumbfounded and stunned. The next morning, she was sitting up in bed. She was off her pressor agents. She got extubated. Her kidney function had improved. And she left the ICU 3 days later. I was stunned. Our nurses were stunned. The residents were stunned. They'd never seen such a thing. This is a woman who we knew was going to die, and she walked out of the hospital. She walked out of the hospital. So, you know, when you see something like this, you say, wow, maybe that was just a fluke. It was just a lucky thing. So I did it again and again and again. And exactly the same thing happened. So we started this as a protocol in our ICU, and this was endorsed by our nurses because they could see the dramatic effect. I mean, the nurses tell the truth. They're the ones at the bedside, and they could, you know, they saw their patients came off pressors very quickly. They came off the ventilator, and they were my biggest supporters, although the hospital tried to the shenanigans trying to silence them, as we'll see. And at one point, I thought about doing a randomized study, and I discussed it with my nurses, who said it was immoral and unethical to do such a thing, because how we have a treatment that saves lives, and now you want to randomize patients to placebo. How's that ethical? So they actually dissuaded me from doing a randomized study. So that's why, you know, we continue to do what we did. And, you know, we published our prospective observational study. And, you know, what we did is we compared our data to retrospective data. We used the same selection criteria, and we showed a significant reduction in mortality from about 40% in ICU to 8%. So these were patients who met certain criteria, who were vasopressor dependent, means they required blood pressure medication to support their blood pressure. These were people at high risk of dying. We showed this dramatic reduction in mortality. And so at the beginning, you know, I was a hero with the hospital. They thought that this was the most wonderful thing. They supported me, they endorsed me, and the dean supported me. So, you know, at that point, I was a hero. But with time, as the, you know, the media and the forces that be started playing out, I became less and less and less popular, to the point, obviously, as I told you, when it came to COVID, I was a pariah, and they wanted to destroy me. And so there is some interesting stories associated with this, and I had really forgotten. So at that time, you know, in the early or late 2017-18, sepsis was a big deal in hospitals, and it was used as one of the indicators of the quality of hospital care, and CMS had quality indicators. So hospital sepsis mortality was a big deal. And so there was a company called Truven, which then became, I think, IBM Watson, and then became some other company, which basically contracted with CMS to report hospital data. So this is completely independent of me. And so what happened is they actually provided the CEO of the hospital with the hospital mortality data. And at that time, the CEO was this CEO, not the subsequent ones, was a very nice man. He was communicative with me. He was respectful of me. He was respectful of what we were doing. He was a kind man. Obviously, that's why he didn't stay there too long. But he actually provided me with the data. So this was independent data from a data analytics company that showed that since I had introduced the protocol in the hospital and mainly in our ICU, the hospital mortality from sepsis fell from 20% to 8%. And so that's independent data, you know, verifying, you know, the effects of this intervention. But obviously, you know, after that, things turned pretty bad. And
before we go there, let me just hold you on for a moment, because I had a few questions with respect to the actual intervention that you established, which I think, you're a pioneer and you've established this in the conventional medical literature. You're an astute researcher with respect to reviewing the scientific literature to have validation and support for your clinical recommendations. So, you know, you initially started at 1.5 grams every 6 hours of the vitamin C. And I'm wondering two things. One, if your subsequent review of the literature and clinical experience has supported a higher intervention. And secondly, if you, with your understanding of the medical science, what do you believe is the mechanism for vitamin C or ascorbic acid being useful in sepsis?
Yes, yeah, so those are really two really good questions. So I must say the first was, you know, when we did this, we were somewhat naive and we didn't put all the dots together. So the actuality is when patients came into the hospital, we treated them pretty quickly, which makes sense. You know, if you're septic, it's a time-sensitive disease. We know time to antibiotics is critical. So what we did is we treated these patients initially when they first arrived in the ICU. So the very first patient, I treated her within an hour or two of being in the ICU. And subsequently, we did the same thing. And we even actually moved it to the emergency room. So patients who were septic, in whom we were consulted to see in the emergency room, you know, we treated them immediately because, you know, that made sense. You know, give them antibiotics, give them vitamin C. So the mistake we made was when we wrote up the paper, we didn't really put together this time-sensitive issue. So we said patients were treated within 24 hours. But, you know, that's what we wrote and that's what we thought. It's only subsequently that I realized how time-sensitive this really is. In reality, our patients were treated within 6 hours. And I think this becomes a fundamental question because I know there have been studies that have reproduced what we did. And all of these studies gave the vitamin C and the dose we used within 10 hours. Then there are many studies that used the same dose but gave patients the vitamin C days later. So, you know, the biggest study published in a New England Journal, which tried to, you know, invalidate our data and make us look, you know, really bad. You know, what we know is we don't know the time to the first dose. It's probably in excess of 18 hours. And in fact, many patients were transferred from one hospital to another hospital. So they were in one ICU. They were admitted there, deemed to be too sick, transferred to another hospital in their ICU. So it was days before they were treated. And in addition, our patients were medical patients, which is really important because surgical sepsis is a surgical disease largely. So in this large, you know, randomized study, which so-called, you know, disproved our paper, the time to initiation of therapy was exceedingly long. Most patients more than 24 hours. Many were surgical patients. And the investigators had previously viciously attacked me, viciously at a, in fact, in an open meeting, they had implicated that I was a snake oil doctor at a meeting in Toronto. They had viciously attacked me. So they were out to-
You were making loads of money for the companies that were selling ascorbic acid, which is almost free.
Oh yes, I was financially empowering myself and Big Pharma and the hospital by selling this expensive drug, which is obviously the issue, is that as we know and as you know, this is a war on repurposed drugs and they will do whatever they can. So, you know, when you look at the data, it seems that if it's given early, that it works. And so I did somewhat of a dose finding study with our initial patients, just based on the variation according to what the pharmacy did. And it seemed like 1.5 grams, if given early, makes a difference. The question now, and this is an important question, and that's why we've changed our protocol. If it's given after 6 to 10 or 12 hours, I think you need a higher dose. And so, you know, we need better dose finding studies. You know, we know it works. So how does it work? Well, we know many patients. So firstly, vitamin C shouldn't be called a vitamin C. It should be called a stress hormone. Because all animals on this planet, except for humans and guinea pigs, make vitamin C when stressed. It's made predominantly by the liver and as well as the kidney. And it's an essential stress hormone. It has multiple modes of action. You know, it's very important for sepsis. It's very important for stress. As I said, it's a stress hormone. So it's a powerful antioxidant. It's required for the synthesis as a cofactor of many, many enzymes and proteins. It's really vital for the immune system. It's important for white cells to function, to make interferon. So it has a host of really important actions. Unfortunately, humans have evolutionarily lost the ability to make vitamin C. And so when patients are septic, they have exceedingly low vitamin C levels. And animal models show that when you replace the vitamin C, it improves outcome. So this is not rocket science. Vitamin C is essential as a stress hormone. It's an essential antioxidant, and sepsis is a potent prooxidant. It's important for the immune system. It's important for the synthesis of catecholamines. It is essential for tissue repair. So it just makes sense that it would be beneficial in sepsis. So you ask a good question is, so, you know, I think because most people criticize this about the dose we used. And the answer is, you know, I'm not sure, to be honest. I think if given early, 1.5 grams 6 hourly is fine, maybe 2 grams. And, you know, Dr. Corey has done work in his ICU, and he found exactly the same thing, that when there's a delay in the initiation of vitamin C, the mortality benefit disappears. Now, the question obviously is, if you give it later, can you use a higher dose? And that's what we're now suggesting, that, you know, if you miss that window of opportunity, you probably need to use a higher dose. What the optimal dose is, I'm not sure. And the reason I had some reservation is that in high doses, paradoxically, vitamin C can act as a pro-oxidant, particularly when there's free metals and free iron. And with sepsis, you do get release of ferritin and iron. So that was our caution. But you're absolutely correct. You know, I think we need to do more research to give you the answer.
And there's also the issue of the oxalate may be metabolized to oxalic acid, which is not a good thing at high doses.
Yes. So the optimal dose, we don't know. I still think if given early, you know, 1.5 or 2 grams Q6 is probably optimal. It's what we would suggest. And there are studies, you know, there was a randomized study done in Taiwan. They couldn't get it published because the results were so striking, and they gave it within 2 hours, and the mortality reduction was completely off the charts. So I think there's a relationship between time and dose. And you know what, like most things in medicine, you know, we don't know all the answers, and the way you answer it is by asking questions and studying it and looking for answers.
Thank you so much for indulging my curiosity and for the curiosity of many as to the historical perspective of how the MERA protocol came to be. So from there, I think now that we've established that, we can review what's happened to you as a result of implementing this, because it's pretty interesting, not surprising, but interesting certainly, that what's happened. You actually, I don't really have the full update now, because I know that your board certification, which I believe is the American Board of Internal Medicine, moved to remove your certification. And that's, you know, so what? Who cares if you're certified from them? Well, it's a big deal, because once you lose that certification, you're not eligible for seeing patients, having patients that you see have their insurance cover your services, and many institutions, hospitals, and companies require that certification to work. So it is a job buster, essentially, if you lose it. Almost like you're losing your license. It's almost comparable in many cases. So I wonder what the status of that is, and then maybe you can discuss what happened in losing your position. You have something I think you popularized, which is sham peer review, where supposedly your peers go through the process of removing you with essentially no legal recourse. So why don't you give us an update as to what's happened to you as a result of your experience with this protocol?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously Math Plus then became an extension of HAP therapy. You know, this was 2020. At that time, the NIH, the CDC, and WHO said there's no treatment for the hospitalized patient with COVID, which is completely absurd. How can a doctor not treat a patient? So we came up with the MATH protocol. It made most sense. We knew this was a profound inflammatory disease and a clotting disease. So as you said, we added methylprednisolone, ascorbic acid, thiamine, and heparin to this protocol. The plus became a number of other things, including melatonin. And, you know, what we demonstrated was a reduction in mortality. And I had data from my own hospital showing the reduction in mortality. And so the first assault against me came when, you know, Pierre, myself, and Jose, we wrote a review paper on Math Plus. It was a review paper. It wasn't basically a observational study. We just reviewed the rationale for Math Plus. And in it, in a small part of it, I quoted the hospital mortality, just one line, and which was 8.6% at that time. And where did I get the data? So I should say that the hospital mortality worldwide at that point was 20%. And we've subsequently published data in peer-reviewed journal showing the average hospital mortality for COVID was 20%. And so the CEO of the hospital, sorry, CMO, let me say that again. The chief medical officer of the hospital personally gave me the data of the hospital mortality at Norfolk General. So this was Dr. Michael Hooper. He personally gave me the data. He told me that, and this was personally, he gave me the data that the hospital mortality was 8.6%. And so that was the data at that time. So as a very small part of this paper, it was included in one of the tables, you know, we said the hospital mortality was 8.6%. Anyway, Centauri Healthcare System and Dr. Hooper basically then complained to the medical school that I had made up the data, I had fabricated the data. Dr. Hooper didn't give me the data. This was completely fabricated. And so they reported this to the medical school. There was a big inquiry. In the end, the hospital actually, the medical school agreed with me, and they did agree that maybe what we should do is just add an addendum that the mortality, as I had quoted, was at that particular time, which was accurate. And obviously with time, as you know, because that was censored, the mortality increased to like 10%. But still, it was substantially less than the world average. Anyway, what happened is the hospital put pressure on the Journal of Intensive Care Medicine, and they forced them to retract my paper or our paper because of scientific fraud and misconduct. And so the journal followed what they said, and clearly there were other extraneous or forces acting with the hospital, but they retracted our paper, Journal of Intensive Care Medicine, which reliably, faithfully, honestly reflected the truth. And so that was really the first major attack on me personally and on the math protocol and against what we were doing. I should add that this wasn't my first run-in with the health system. They had actually accused me of scientific misconduct a few months previously. They had accused me of plagiarizing an IRB protocol. Have you ever heard of such a thing? So I applied to the IRB for a protocol to study our COVID data, and Centauri.
What is the IRB?
The IRB is Institutional Review Board. So whenever you do a study looking at human data, it's standard across the US and the world, you have to provide your protocol to the Institutional Review Board, which looks at the data, make sure that it satisfies certain criteria, and give you permission. So the hospital, believe it or not, I don't think this has ever happened before, accused me of plagiarizing a IRB protocol. So they were after me. They were after me because I had shown...
All right, go listen to the whole thing. It's called A New Vision for Healthcare. That's on his. We're going to go into two other things and finish it off. Here we go. If you've never listened to this, you can go listen to also this next whole episode is one of them I did, like episode 26 on the cannabinoid system.
Hard to fully understand this system. So my goal was to put together a very sophisticated and very complex training so that medical practitioners could get it all in one place. They didn't have to research all over the place to find out what was actually happening with the system, endocannabinoids and the signaling within this whole system. I wanted to set it up so that it was all in one place and easy to get. But what I started realizing was that it's more of a system that can actually be a roadmap for us to health. And I felt, well, there are a lot more consumers out there than there are medical practitioners. Mm-hmm. And maybe the best thing to do was to educate a consumer market.
Hmm. It is, because I don't think it's well understood, and it's self-regulation because of where these... Explain a little bit, if someone has no anatomy and physiology, what the endocannabinoid system is. Compare it to, say, the immune system, or we can compare it more similar to the nerve system.
Sure. So the most important thing about the endocannabinoid system is that it is a regulatory system. Its ultimate goal is to achieve and maintain homeostasis, which is perfect cellular balance in the body, or equilibrium. And so it's constantly working to do that. And it's found in every single system of the body. And what we now know in science is that it is the regulatory system to all of the other body systems. So in the early stages, we believed that it was found, there are two classical cannabinoid receptors called CB1 and CB2. Yeah. And it was believed that CB1 is found to express mostly within the brain, central and peripheral nervous systems, whereas CB2 was found to express in the immune system. And that was like the nutshell, so to speak. What we now understand is that it expresses much more diversely. CB2 receptors are found on some neurons, they're found in the brain. CB1 receptors are also found within the immune system and play a role in illness and disease as well, especially when we look at overexpression of receptors. And so, simply put, it's a three-part system consisting of endocannabinoids, which the body produces, just like in cannabis, the cannabis plant, THC and CBD, those are phytocannabinoids. Mm-hmm. In the body, they're called endocannabinoids. And so the body manufactures them. And then the third part, you've got your CB receptors, you have your endocannabinoids, and then you have these precursor enzymes, because again, we stated that the body doesn't store them in little vesicles like it does other neurotransmitters. Instead, they're created on demand when the body calls for them. So it's important as well to understand that even though simply it's a three-part system, it's also diet dependent. So if you don't eat the right kinds of omegas, your body's going to need these endocannabinoids. And when it goes to get them, when it's in crisis, it's going to go, okay, come on, I need you. I've wounded myself, or I've damaged something, or I've got an imbalance in this body system. Fire up. You're going to get nothing. You're not going to get the levels that you need.
Yeah. That is, because you go into the... There's so much greatness in this, but I suggest any nurses that are into oils, as I'm in, into natural healing, or anyone in the healthcare system or wanting to better themselves to definitely buy this book. And you have another book that's going to be coming out I'm super excited about. But when you're looking, I love this one picture right here, because you have a picture in here that kind of expresses this cannabinoid receptor expression and kind of where they're at, the CB1 and the CB2, where they're found in the body.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of cool because you find them all over.
Right. Absolutely. We even have an endocannabinoid system of the skin. We have a lot of...
Okay, so you can go listen to that whole episode if you've not listened to that. If you're really interested in like THC, CBD, and you're using THC and CBD, and you want to know more about what it's doing in your body, you need to go listen to that whole episode. Now let's go into a little bit of Dr. T and Dr. P.
Here it is, Prevnar 20. So we started at Prevnar 7. We then went to Prevnar 13. We're now at Prevnar 20. And don't you worry, there are a little over 90 serotypes for Streptococcus pneumonia. And so we're working our way up there, so that we can cover every single one of the serotypes, so that you can feel protected from bacterial infections that the majority of the population carries anyway.
You know, it was interesting when they did Prevnar 7 and then they went to Prevnar 11, And then they went to 13, then they went to 15. I remember we were, you know, putting stuff in the Tenpenny Research Library, and Cindy was building it. I remember her saying, this was, I don't know, however many years ago that we went to Prevnor 11. She said, I went at that time point in time, they had identified 80 serotypes. She said, I wonder when they're going to have Prevnor 80. And I could only find, I haven't looked recently, but this was several years ago. I could only find one study that was done on the adult pneumonia shot, which is essentially Prevnar 21. It's got 21 strains. And what they did was they gave one shot, may have been two, but they gave one or two shots, and then some period of time in the future, they checked to see how many of the 21 antigens had actually developed antibodies. And it was like five out of like the, and yet at the time, you know, they would tell adults you only needed to get one pneumonia shot in your lifetime. And then they went to every 10 years and then to every 5 years. And now they're saying every year with your flu shot, you should get this 21 antigen vaccine loaded with phenols and all kinds of stuff inside of it. I don't know, Larry, sometimes it just gets so discouraging.
Well,
you know, the thing about RSV vaccines, I mean, RSV, the ones that had always been on the market, they took them off the market because of antigen-dependent enhancement. And they also had, you know, the side effects from the RSV vaccine was exactly the same as getting RSV. I mean, it's a transient infection that doesn't really, it's less serious than even the flu. I don't know.
Sometimes what I find interesting about this thing is, one, any attempt to make an mRNA RSV vaccine in the past has failed. And two, look what it says. After a 60-year scientific quest, the world has its first vaccine to protect against RSV, and more are on the way. On Wednesday, the USDA approved Arexvy, made by GlaxoSmithKline, which is designed to be given as a single shot to adults 60 and older.
To adults?
Right. That's why.
Oh my God.
That's why I wanted you to see this. Because where?
And why did I say that? You guys that are listening, it's because every adult, by the time they're probably 18, has been exposed to RSV and has a natural immunity to it. So now they're giving this to the elderly? One more thing to kill people with, I guess.
It could be available for seniors as soon as this fall, pending a recommendation for its use from the US CDC. Now, I found that so interesting because where in our medical careers do we see a plethora of RSV pathology in any other population other than
preemies,
infants, and toddlers?
Yeah, but preemies especially, you know, that's the ones that they get all in their knickers in a knot about. If you've got preemies, you've got to protect them against RSV, not because it's deadly. It's not about mortality, it's about morbidity. That if these are premature infants and they're, you know, they're 3 months premature, they're teeny tiny, if they get RSV, they need to be hospitalized. That's morbidity. They don't die. They get morbidity. So they're doing this to keep kids out of the hospital, which the side effects from the shots are the same as getting RSV. I mean, I have a really good friend, Larry. He's a fellow DO. He's about my age. And he's got triplets. And I think his triplets are probably 16 now. They're teenagers. But I remember when they were born and they, you know, in the hospital, I'll never forget this. They were born in December. And the little Christmas card they sent out was like those red stockings that you hang on your fireplace banner. And one of each of the kids was inside of it. It was the cutest little thing. I was 18 years ago and I still remember it. But I remember him saying how hard they were pushing them because they had already decided they were not going to vaccinate their kids. But because they were born, and it wasn't even that much, it was maybe 3 or 4 weeks early, you know, but prior to their due date, but they were not underdeveloped, they were not underweight, but they were just small. I mean, they're triplets, right? Pushed so hard, and they couldn't believe that their dad was a physician and was not willing to give them these RSV things. And when I showed him the pack, I just said, Mike, read the package insert, man, just read it. And he read it and he went, why would anybody do this? You know, and that was, well, like I said, I think his triplets are, I'm guessing they're around 16 now, 15, 16. That was that long ago that it was a nonsensical, unnecessary, horrible shot. And now here we are giving it to seniors. I mean, it's just, it's.
If you didn't get what I wanted to grasp in this whole episode is, I think, is that if you don't understand all this medical jambra talk, it's why to have an advocate there for you. I just recently had a friend of a family member, and they got hospitalized, and you know, family member reaches out to me and I be their advocate. And I'm like, I do this for free, but I also do this as my business, because sometimes you need someone there that can just help you make sense of the whatever decision you decide to make. You get all the information you want from the physician, from what you're reading, from your health coach, from your nurse, from different people, and you decide what's best for your health. That is up to you. And if you can't decide, you have to have someone in sound mind that can speak for you. And that is so important in this day and age. So this is what this episode is about. Look forward to talking to you more.